My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion. I'm not an expert on alcoholism. I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got some opinions. This has been a wonderful conference for me, and I think probably for you. I want to thank Bill and Linda for asking me to be here and assigning me Marvin, who's been a joy, and the committee. I mean, the work you've done. There's something very, very special about this. In my life and times, I've gotten to travel around the country and been in a lot of these kind of things, and this is what Clancy talks about when he talks about pockets of enthusiasm. I mean, you can feel it here in this room. You can feel it. You've been warm and welcoming to me and to all of us. And I the wonderful thing about it being asked to do these things is you get to hear great speakers. Not me, but I mean, you get to hear. I get to hear, you know, old friends and new friends. Donna, I've never heard before, and she was wonderful. And June, I remember her exactly as she described herself to you, and it was pretty frightening. And Sandy is, you know, we've got to find a way to cut him up and send him out as Christmas presents. I feel like the guy at the end of the parade with the with the broom, sweep, what, and get out of show business. You know, but the thing about this is, for me, is it's broken loose some memories for me that this process of being sober if you make a commitment to this kind of spiritual path, however that's defined for you, it never stops. It just never stops. It's there's no destinations. It's all a journey. It's and for me, it's been way more than a journey. It continues to be an adventure. Some things have happened to me listening to the people share their experience, strength, and hope. And I'll just kind of bounce some stuff around. I mean, it's Sunday morning, and I've had 9 cups of coffee, so God knows what's going to come up. I spent some time with my sponsor this week. I am sponsored. I want to thank you for reading that, Bill. They read that every Thursday night at my home group. My home group is the Happy Destiny group in Vancouver, British Columbia. We meet at the corner of Burrard and Georgia in downtown Vancouver in the basement of the church. I love church basements. And if you're ever in Vancouver and you need a meeting on a Thursday night at 8 o'clock, come by. I insist on folding up the chairs and mopping the floor. That's my service thing right now, and has been for a number of months. I like that one. And I spent a lot of time in Vancouver sitting down, shutting up, and listening. And I do most of my talking out on the road, which is fine. I had to go to my sponsor this week, and because a guy I sponsor called me and said, I got this terrific deal. And I said, oh, yeah. And and it involved multi-level marketing of some juice that would make me look 20 years old or something. I don't know. Anyway, but I had to look at myself and I had to decide whether I wanted to do that. It was a great deal. I mean, it was a wonderful thing. I'm making fun of it, and I shouldn't. And I had to go sit down with my sponsor because I'm going to be 66 at the end of this month, and when people have said to me, "Are you retired?" I say, "No. I do some acting stuff, and I'm writing, and I produce, and no. And the fact is, I'm retired. I'm an old fart. I'm old. I'm a senior citizen. I'm a golden ager. I'm all those god-awful phrases. And the only reason I tell you that is I look younger than 66. I mean, if I look 66, I keep my mouth shut. But I had to look at the fact that I've been working since I was 10 years old. I started out, delivering papers when I was 10 years old, and I have always had a job. And although I have, I have long ago in Alcoholics Anonymous given up the idea that I am what I do, I still have not given up the idea that I'm a worker. And that I have to face the fact that I am not a worker now, that it's time for me to let somebody else do the work and, somebody else do that stuff that I love to do. And it's time for me to allow myself to fully enter the third act of my life. And so I had to go to my sponsor and talk about that. And he had to talk to me about the reality of my life. He made me do some writing. I tell other people to write. So I did that, and I shared it with him, and he told me that I'm old. And I have to deal with it. And so here I am. There's been a lot of talk about being Irish Catholic, I'm Glasgow Irish and Glasgow Scottish, which is a very special breed. And but I was raised Catholic. I was taught how to be a man by men who had given it up, and I was went to Catholic schools all my life. And alcoholism was simply the element that our family lived in. I was like Billy. I had, 50 first cousins, and we would gather. At my great aunt Mary and Uncle Alex's house. They had a big, huge house in Victoria, British Columbia, which is right on the west coast of Canada, and that's where the family parties happened. At the time that I was born, I was 3 years old when the Second World War ended, and the men came back. And as I was 4 and 5 and 6 years old, the parties were in full swing at Aunt Mary's house. Aunt Mary had a huge living room with a whole bunch of ugly old overstuffed furniture and a piano. And it was long before the days of television, so the way that we entertained ourselves was people drank and smoked and sang. And they drank. They drank a lot. They drank they drank to celebrate the fact that they were still alive. And they had gone off, young men, and they had come back enormously changed. They came back as strangers to their wives and strangers to their children. And they had seen things and done things that they never talked about. There was an entire generation that I was raised with who people who had experienced that war who never, ever talked about it. It was never discussed. I never heard the stories. My father from the Merchant Marine, I never heard those stories. All I knew is that on occasional, some nights, he would wake up screaming. And they drank. And slowly what happened is as it got into the 50s and it started to be a problem. But it was simply what we did, and I was an odd child. I was a quiet, reclusive child. I learned to read very, very early. It was my first escape. It was the first way that I got out of the reality of my life. I would read books and go to wherever that book took me, and I was smart and articulate and quiet and reclusive and. My family was not physically violent. My family was emotionally and verbally violent. They were incredibly, incredibly verbal and incredibly bright and could say things to you that were like razor slashes. They would say something and 2 hours later you would see the thin lines, blood, They were extraordinary. Men did not strike women in my family. They certainly struck children, but they did not strike women. And what came up for me is the disaster of the drinking and the alcoholism proceeded, and you know, some of them had what they called the failing. I was to develop the failing, and but I remember those parties, and what you tore loose for me this weekend was a memory that I have not thought of in 60 years. At one of those parties, what would happen is as the party was would get down to 1 o'clock, 1:30, 2 o'clock, the women would start to clean up. The women would start to clean up the party, and they would go into the kitchen with my great Aunt Mary, and they would start washing and cleaning up. And the men would sit in a circle in the living room, and my great aunt, my great uncle Alec would bring out a special bottle, and he would say, "A wee dram for the journey," and they'd pour it all the way around. And they would sit there, these men who had seen God knows what, and they would sit there with that thousand-mile stare as they sipped the dram, not looking at each other, just looking into some memory, some place they'd been. And one of them would start. And this particular night I remember, because the kids got to stay upstairs, we got to stay overnight, and I would always sneak down to the stairs to watch, because a moment would start. Sometimes Moira would come to the party, and she had a harp, an honest-to-God full harp, and she would play. And one of my uncles, George, played a pipe, and there was always a violin or a fiddle around. And they had been singing all their songs, and then it would settle down, and I knew this sound. And it got very, very quiet, and I knew that Uncle Alec was pouring the dram. And one of them would start. "I once loved a lass, I loved her, say well, I hated all others who spake of her ill, and she has rewarded me well for my love. She soon will be wed to another." And then the basses would come in underneath that. And there were a couple of brilliant tenors that would come in, and they would sing through that song. And as they sang through the song, the activity in the kitchen stopped. And the women came to the kitchen door and into the dining room. And with their arms folded and leaning against it, they would listen to the men sing. And the men would sing the songs of the old country. They'd sing the songs of being displaced. They'd sing the songs of longing for home. They'd sing the songs of love. They'd sing the ancient songs from the Celts and the Picts and the Angles. They'd sing the songs that came from the earth and the sky, from Ireland, from Scotland. And they'd sing them, and it was magical. It was magical. And they'd sing of what they saw, and they'd sing about where they'd been. And I will never, ever forget it. It was this music that filled my soul, that this is a group, and what would happen is then eventually the women would filter in, and they would stand behind the men in the circles, and they would join in. Deep alto voices, sad, beautiful alto voices, and clear sopranos. And they would sing in 8-part, 12-part, 16-part harmony. It was unbelievable. And what released that, I could tell, was alcohol. So I not only saw the disaster of alcohol in my life, I saw the beauty of it. And it was always a conflict for me. One night, that started, and they were singing the old songs. And I stepped into the circle. I was 8 years old. I had white blonde hair and huge blue eyes. And I stepped into the circle and opened my mouth and started to sing one of the old songs. My mother stepped forward and my father went like this and held her back. And I finished the verse. And a voice from the circle said, "Sing the rest, lad." And as I sang the next verse, they joined in. And underneath me and around me, the sound. And we sang through it and through it and through it. And then another voice said, "Sing it again, lad." And I sang it again, and it happened again. And my mother came out and took me in her arms, and her tears running down her eyes, and she took me over to my father, and I sat underneath my father's arm, and they allowed me to sit there, and we sang through all the old songs. From that moment on, whenever there was a party, the lad had to sing. They told me I had a tear in my voice. And the next year they put me in a boys' choir. By the time I was 10 years old, I was singing in churches and weddings and concerts and earning money doing it. I also started delivering papers and earning money. And I had that moment of being under my father's arm, surrounded by those men, singing their hearts and their souls out, was a feeling I was not to feel ever again until I reached Alcoholics Anonymous. I took with me something that I didn't know about, but something that was analyzed in me about 10 years ago. I suffered from a slightly depressive state called dysthymia. I have a kind of, I'm just a little under the surface. And I also have something that is known as adult attention deficit. So, pretty common in alcoholics, you know. And so I carried that with me. I was always kind of struggling with what I was doing. But I came to find out some truths about myself. One of the things was my father wanted me to be better than he was. My father was an alcoholic. He was a drinker. And he was to become a disastrous alcoholic. And he wanted me to be better than he was. There was a whole generation of those men who wanted their children to surpass them. And I was a smart kid. I was always at the top of my class. I was always getting A's and B pluses and A pluses and all that kind of stuff. And I would bring home a report card that had 5 A's and 1 B plus. And my father would say, "A B plus? You can do better than that. You have extraordinary brains. You are a bright man. You can be whoever you want to be." And what he was saying to me was, "You are so extraordinary that you can do this." What I heard was, "You're not good enough." I've always had a problem with my hearing. And what that developed into me was a series of voices that were in my head that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous, as we all do, the jury, you know, that's out and not very friendly. And oddly enough, in the times that I have been sober, those voices have distilled down to one. Still down to one. And oddly enough, it sounds like my father. That's a voice that says, "You're not good enough. You never were good enough. You never will be good enough. Why bother?" And what I do is I say, "Thank you for sharing. Now piss off." But it's there. Never goes away. Oh, it does, but I mean, it comes back. It comes back when I'm not doing the stuff I should be doing. I took that singing voice to Broadway when I was 20 years old. I was in New York for 10 years. I did several Broadway shows as a singer. I did a lot of national tours. I achieved some extraordinary things way beyond a little Irish kid from Victoria. But something had happened to me when I was 14 years old. I got drunk for the first time. And when I was 14 years old and got drunk, I realized all my potential. I was everything I needed to be. I was socially adept. I was attractive. I was bright. I was charming. I was all those things that my father wanted me to be. Shortly thereafter, I started enhancing that effect with drugs, prescription drugs. And by the time I was 18 years old, I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says. If you've ever said it, you're an alcoholic. If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're listening to an alcoholic. And that phrase is, I can control my drinking. I was 18 years old and I was in trouble with the alcohol and I was in trouble with the drugs, but the idea of living without them was terrifying to me. Because what had slowly dawned on me was that I couldn't be who I wanted to be without drinking and using. So I was somehow going to modify it and control it and work it out. I went to New York. Huge accomplishments. I was living in the middle of a dream. And by the time I was 24 years old, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day and picked up a little non-habit forming marijuana habit. And I it was the 60s. And I was working the docks. Doctors. I love doctors because they're so stupid. You know, what I learned very quickly is that doctors don't know how to say goodbye without writing something. And if you give them the right information, they'll write what you want. And so I always had three on the line, and so I had a lot of prescriptions. I lived in the wonderful world of chemistry. By the time I was 20 years old, I was in deep trouble, and I started going to moral superiors for help. I started going to psychiatrists and psychologists and gurus and spiritual people and doctors and, you know, priests and monsignors and nuns and policemen, judges, and lawyers, and I explained to them my problem, and they would point at me and say, this is what you should do about it, and anybody who points a finger at me and says, this is what you should do, I bite it off at the knuckle. I married above my station. I moved to California. That would do it. And we got married, and she settled down. And and on April 23rd, 1974, I was 31 years old and my life blew up in front of me. Just blew up. And I had a couple of revelations that night that were like being slapped in the face. One of them was that I could not drink and use. And the other one was that my life was over, but I was not going to die. And I took aside somebody that I was working with. Her name was Suzanne, and I told her the truth. I said the last phrase. I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I have about 20 minutes before I go to pieces. She dropped everything. She canceled all her appointments that day. She 12-stepped me. She told me about the program, and she took me to my first meeting. And somehow in that day, I got the sense that I only had one shot at this. And I have always had that sense. So if this is the first time you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome. This is my first time, too. I started this journey, and I started the journey. I mean, that first meeting, I used to say that I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the minute I walked in, and that's not true. I mistook feeling safe for love. But I felt safe in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I don't know why. I felt understood and accepted. I felt like I was sitting underneath my father's arm. And when I allow myself, I still feel that way. I don't know how to describe to you what 34 years in Alcoholics Anonymous is like. It's an incredible, incredible adventure. I'm getting to that kind of age in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been around, you know, I keep upping the requirement for old timer. You know, it used to be, you know, now it's somebody with 40 years is an old timer. You know, I don't want to get there yet, but I suppose a bunch of us qualify. I suppose we qualify now, Jim. We've been so young for so long. I was raised in a religion that I rejected because I didn't hear what they were saying correctly. What they told me was that there was this old dude with a beard who had a book, who was writing down everything that I did and everything that I thought of doing, for which I was going to be punished with eternal flames, with devils flailing my flesh off with whips, but that he loved me. Now, I'm not sure that that's what they taught me, but that's what I heard. And I was a thinker, so I was in trouble. So I rejected that. And by the time I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, my spiritual life consisted of the two alcoholic prayers, "Dear God, get me out of this, and I will never do it again." And whew. On the day that she 12 set me, Suzanne looked at me that afternoon before I went to my first meeting. She said, "Do you believe in God?" And I said, "I suppose so." And she said, "That's good enough." And so I went to my first meeting. My second meeting was June's home group. And I went to these huge meetings, and I got sober when Alcoholics Anonymous was still sleazy. You know, when you really didn't want to tell anybody you were in this organization, you know, before it became the disease of the week, you know, before celebrities with 3 months sobriety were becoming role models for our children. Yeah. It was really kind of embarrassing to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was telling you, you know, I don't want to sound like, you know, "I used to walk 50 miles through the snow to go to an AA meeting." You know. But we did get sober in the rooms because there weren't any other places to get sober. I was one of the group that they gave half a cup of coffee to because I was a little jumpy when I arrived. I detoxed in the rooms, and I mean, people, you know, I'd be, you know, people like me would be up here talking, and somebody over there would have a grand mal seizure, you know, and be flipping like a salmon, you know. And somebody would stick a wallet in his mouth so he wouldn't bite his tongue off and call the ambulance, and they'd come, and the guy would just continue talking. I mean, no, you know. And the wonderful thing is your sponsor would nudge you in the ribs and say, "Keep drinking, that'll happen to you." So I want to thank all the grand mal seizure guys because they kept me sober one more day because I sure didn't want to do that, you know. And we were just nuts. And I started working the steps. I didn't talk about them. I didn't go to groups to study them. I didn't dissect them. One of the first people that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous was a guy named Max. Max was about this tall, and Max had this thick German accent. Max was a Holocaust survivor, and he was Otto Preminger's vocal coach. Otto Preminger had a thick German accent, so I'm sure that Max sounded just perfect to him, but you could barely understand Max. He had this stare. And the only thing that I ever remember Max saying to me was, "Don't analyze, utilize." But he had some pretty hefty credentials. I mean, so I, okay, Max. And I mean, there were those guys. There were these old farts around, which I'm resisting becoming, but find myself being drawn into. We used to sit in meetings, and like if I said, you know, I was watching this television program, somebody out there would say, "Outside issue!" You'd snap, too. Oh, sorry about that. They were incredible. And they said dumb shit like, you know, "I spilled more in my tie than you drank," and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But there were also these incredible guys, and I was new and scared and desperately wanted to be sober. And, you know, like they'd gather over at the coffee pot, you know, and they'd be pouring coffee and talking to each other. And I would kind of sneak over and hope they didn't see me, you know, kind of stand close to listen to what they were saying. And they were walking the walk and they were talking the talk. I got a sponsor, and he started me down this journey. And this is a Sunday morning meeting, so a lot of times they talk about this being the spiritual meeting, but I'm of the opinion that any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is the spiritual meeting. But my journey in finding a way to live inside spiritual principles has been an interesting one, probably more interesting for me than it is for you. But I wanted desperately to get this. I never wanted to drink again. I never wanted to hate myself that much again. So they took me through this thing, and the first three steps are the preparation leading up to the third step, which is the decision to live my life based on spiritual principles. And then those steps through the ninth steps are finding out what those principles are, starting to put them into action. And then the 10th, 11th, and 12th step for me have been the maintenance and enhancing of that. But I went fearfully into that because I had a real bad track record with God, as I understood God. Over the years I sponsored a lot of guys, and I've seen a lot of guys come in and go out. And the guys that have gone out, if they make it back, I always try to kind of engage them and ask them questions without interrogating them, to find out what it was. And what it has boiled down to that I have found is that the people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous and don't stay are the ones who refuse to make the decision in the third step and the ones who will not complete their ninth step. It's inevitably, that's what it is. They won't clean up the wreckage completely. So what is the third step, and what is this spiritual life for me? I've been just trying to comprehend it, which is a little ludicrous. I mean, if I could comprehend God, as it was said, God wouldn't be large enough to take care of my needs. But I heard the thing that happens at Alcoholics Anonymous, if you sit around here and I've tried desperately to listen to the similarities and not the differences. It is the thing that has kept me sitting in rooms where I did not want to be there. When I thought the guy standing up there in the gray hair and the tie was an absolute jerk, I would force myself to find something that I identified with. And I always did when I made that decision. But what it does is it opens up my mind to possibilities that are beyond, which was basically a closed system when I arrived here. And I have heard remarkable things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have heard things like what happened to me this weekend that have dislodged memories, that have made me look at things in a different way. But I was listening to the radio one day. Up in Canada, we have a wonderful national radio called CBC, and they have it's talk all day, but they have really interesting people. And there was a Zen guy talking. He was a Zen Buddhist, and he was talking about the nature of God. Driving on an afternoon, listening to the nature of God. Boy. That ain't me, but anyway. And he was talking about the fact for him is that embrace, you know, believing and trusting is one thing, but moving into what God is what the big deal is. I come from the Pacific Northwest. The western part of Canada is a very, very beautiful place, and it's covered in forests that go on for thousands and thousands of miles. Dense, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful And for me, the third step to make a commitment, making a decision, the third step is not that I understand God. You know, the third step, there's that word in there, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand God. And the decision is like this. If I decide that I want a house, I don't get the key. If I make the decision that I want a house, and then what I do is I pick up a newspaper or go on the internet and find somebody who's a realtor and then go look at some houses, and eventually I find the house that I want, and I make an offer, and there's a counter offer, and we go back and forth, and we eventually agree on the price, and then I go get, you know, a loan from the bank and title insurance and an inspection of the house, and there's all kinds of processes, and eventually when all that stuff is taken care of, all these steps, I get the key to the house. Well, that's what the third step is that I make the decision to step into a spiritual life. And what that is like for me is walking into the forest. Now, if you walk into a forest as dense and as beautiful as where I live, there are two ways to look at it. It's either incredibly beautiful and teeming with life and light and shadow and greatly beautiful and awe-inspiring, or it's terrifying and dangerous. It just depends on what my attitude is. Well, I walked in awe-inspired because I'm not very bright. And I've tried as best I can to live there, live within it. When you live inside a forest, you can't describe it to anybody. You can't tell them how tall it is, or how many acres it is, how long it is, how wide it is, because you live inside it. And that's what's happened to me over the years as far as my understanding and comprehension of God, is become less and less able to describe it because I have tried to live inside it. Now, I've been sober a long time for me. I wasn't planning on being here this long. I really wish I were a better example, but, you know, I am who I am. I have no wisdom. All I have is experience. But what happens in sobriety, even when we're doing it right, you know, we're working the steps, and we're you know, sponsoring guys, and we're in service, and we're active in our home groups, and we're doing all the stuff, sometimes we get lost. Sometimes we find we're lost. You know, I've been given the map. I've been given the 12 steps, you know, but I'm not a great map reader, I've found. And what happens is sometimes in the depths of this great forest, I find out I don't know where I am, that I don't know what to do. And it's certainly no deficiency in my intellect. I'm a fairly bright guy. It's no deficiency in my sincerity. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just that sometimes I just get lost. Now, the worst thing for me when I get lost is to panic, is to start running around, is to start looking what's going on, you know? Because the problem with me as an alcoholic, and I don't know whether it's with you too, is panic feels like pain to me. Panic always turns into pain. And if I continue to panic, the pain gets so intense that I start thinking of ways to fix that fast. So what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I'm lost, I need to stand still. I need to stop. Now, sometimes I'm lost emotionally, and sometimes I got to do what the old-timers used to say is sometimes you got to stand there and let it hurt. We live in a society that hates pain. We live in a society that tells us that none of us should feel any pain at all. That we should always be happy. That we should always feel good. Well, I don't live in that society for some reason. I mean, stuff happens to me. So I stand still. And then what I got to do is I got to say out loud, in as loud a voice as I can, "Hey, I'm lost over here. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what I got to do here. Is there anybody out there? Can anybody give me a hand?" And what I have found is that when I say that out loud, that I don't know what to do, that the real work has begun. When I say out loud, I don't know where to go, the journey has commenced. It's the first step. And what will happen to me is I'll be standing there like this, and somebody will slip their hand in mine, and they'll say, I think it's this way. This is, you've never said this is what you should do. You've always said, this is what I've done. When I've told you what's been going on with me, when I've been honest enough or had the courage to tell you who I was, you've always said, I know how you feel. And that's always dampened down the anxiety enough for me to listen. And so, at first it was my sponsor, you know, out in front of me with my hand, you know, taking me by the hand. And then eventually what happens with sponsorship, which is really interesting, is they switch places with you. You know? What they do, instead of taking you by the hand in front of you, they get behind you. And they start pushing you in the small of your back. Saying, go on. You're going to be okay. Go on. It's all going to be all right. And it has been. Alcoholics Anonymous restores us to normal life. Real life. And real life for me, real life for me is as much as dreams realized and work rewarded and love found as it is for mistakes made, roads not taken, loyalties betrayed. It is everything. It's the whole package. And you know what? I live sometimes with a little regret for things that I haven't done or didn't do right. But that little regret makes the gratitude sweeter. I'm a very grateful man. I'm a very grateful man. I have lived well beyond my life expectation for somebody who was drinking and using and doing the stupid things that I was doing. I've been useful for a lot of years. I've been useful to my family. I've been useful in my community. I've been useful in Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing that Alcoholics Anonymous did for me is not only to be useful in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's released me into my community. I do volunteer work in my community. I teach children drama. I work with a theater company for disabled actors. I'm an active member of my community. I now find myself, you know, a stunning example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a newcomer's worst nightmare. I am sober, old, and alone. I told you I married above my station. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I became an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my wife became an active member of Al-Anon. And we started out on this journey. We talked at conventions together. We were a couple. However, what became increasingly apparent in the last 10 years, I've had a series of kind of blows to me. My last parent died. My mother died. I've had a series of jobs that have not worked out. I lost with a bad investment an enormous amount of money. I had a heart attack. I've had skin cancer, something that has been an ongoing fight with me, and just a series of things that I have had to kind of, you know, suit up and show up for. They didn't seem to me, because of this fellowship, to be enormous challenges. They just seemed to be the thing in front of me that needed to be dealt with today. You know, luckily, what happens in this fellowship is life gets to be in bite-sized chunks. You know, all I got to do is deal with that today. You know, and so I have done that and have been through a whole lot. I my family doctor at one point sat me down and said, "So what's been going on?" So I told him, and he went, "Oh my God." And so he gave me this form, and he said, "Fill this out." So I filled it out. I answered all these questions, and he looked at it, and he said, "You're clinically depressed." I said, "Oh, swell. You know, I'm not bubbling over, but, you know." So he said, "We can put you on some meds." And I said, no, we're not going to do that. So what we did was we did a fairly intensive vitamin B therapy and changed my diet and a whole lot of stuff. And, you know, I'm back up there. But 2 years ago, she said, "I can't do this anymore." And I said, "I don't think you should have to." And that's how our marriage ended. There was no scandal. There was no third person. There was nothing for the AA rumor mill. Wasn't even very interesting. We decided not to wait until the children were dead. So we got a mediator, and we mediated the end of a 35-year marriage. Nobody gets out of that without scars. Nobody gets out of that without wounds and bruises. No matter how much of a program you work, no matter how much you're talking to your sponsor, which I was and am. And we went our separate ways. Did we wish the best for each other? Absolutely. Do we have lunch frequently? No. We tried very hard not to put my daughter in the center of it. Well, she made that very clear when we sat down and told her. She said, "This is the stupidest thing you have ever done, but don't expect me to take sides. I don't want to hear from either of you about the other one." So we said, "Fair enough." She's been raised with this program. She's not in the program. She's just been raised with the principles. So I am now a man on my own. So I for the first time in years and years and years, I had to deal with whether alone slips into loneliness or whether alone stays as not attached. And the only thing for loneliness that I have found, and I have observed it in you people going through it, and you have shared with me how you've done it, is to increase my community and my involvement in my community. So I sponsor a few more guys. I go to a few more meetings. I have stepped back more actively into Alcoholics Anonymous. And also, I've stepped into the theater community in Vancouver. I am now I'm actively on several boards for the Professional Theater Alliance in Vancouver, and I told you I'm teaching and doing all that kind of stuff. So I don't have a whole lot of time for self contemplation. I'm busy, but occasionally. Occasionally there'll be a field of tulips or a sunset, you know, that I'll turn to say, "Look," and there's nothing. It jabs a little. But I'm okay. I've had to write and look at it and talk to my sponsor about it, and what I've come up with is I have experienced a great love. And there are people in the world who have never experienced that. I've experienced it. And once is enough. I'm not looking to replicate it. But I was talking to my sponsor. My sponsor is a guy named Milton, and Milton has Alzheimer's. So I'm losing him. I'm losing him by inches. He can't remember what he had for breakfast, but if you put him up at a podium, he's a barn burner. He's incredible. He's incredible. And he's known me for 34 years. So he remembers all the stuff. And what he's pointed out to me is that I'm still pretty much the same as I was when I arrived. And so he's got all the information on me. Bill and I had breakfast this morning, and Marvin and Bill said, "Are you looking around for another guy to talk to?" And I said, "No, I can't do that yet. It would be disloyal." So, but he's the guy. He's my go-to guy. I need to be known. I need to be known. I believe that's what we come in here with, so many secrets. We come in here as unwelcome guests, as aliens, as renegades, as outlaws, and we have a desperate need to have somebody know us. Just somebody who's got the information, you know. And Milton's got the information. I'll tell you a little story about that. I was telling him. Milton, like me, was a singer. We have that in common. Milton's got a beautiful singing voice. And he was part, in the late 40s, he was part of a group called Billy Ward and the Dominoes. And Billy Ward and the Dominoes had a song in 1949 called 60 Minute Man, which was about a guy who could, yeah, you figure it out. And it was a pretty controversial song. And I happened to go to I was talking at a conference in Cleveland, and I went to the Rock and Roll Museum, and there was a plaque, you know, there was the information on Billy Ward and the Dominoes. And I went up to the office and I said, "I know one of the guys from Billy Ward and the Dominoes." And they said, "Oh, give us the information. We'd like to keep track of these guys." So I gave him all that stuff. So I told Milton when I came home, and he said, "Well, you know," he was going to talk at a conference, and he said, "I'm going to go and get some, you know, see it and check it out and go get some t-shirts for my grandkids." And I said, "Cool." Sometimes you look for opportunities for the men who have guided you and walked you through your life. And how do you say thank you? How do you say thank you to somebody who's listened to me, who's guided me, who has loved me unconditionally for years and years and years? How do you say that, you know? So I emailed the Rock and Roll Museum and said, "This guy's coming on this particular Saturday. You might want to meet him." Within 3 hours, they emailed me back and said, "We definitely want to meet this guy." So I set it all up, and a friend was going to pick him up. And it was going to be a surprise, but I decided not to, because surprises are basically hostile. You know, surprises are designed to make, you know, to put you off guard, which is not fair to do. So just before he left, I told him what I had done, and he got real mad at me because he hadn't talked about it in years, and it was part of his past. And he got real mad at me. He said, "You shouldn't have done that." And I said, "Well, I did it, you know. Deal with it." And, so he went to the Rock and Roll Museum, and this friend of ours said, "You know, I'm with Milton." And they said, "Oh, please, you know, wait in the lobby." And down the stairs came the executive director, who said, "Milton, welcome to your home," and took him on a tour and showed him all the stuff, and took him to up into the office, and he said, "I need to ask you a question." And he said, "Sure." And he said, "Billy Ward and the Dominoes were the first black group to ever open in a main room in Las Vegas. Bobby Darin was their opening act." They were quite an extraordinary group. And he said, "While you were here in Cleveland promoting it with Alan Freed, the rock and roll disc jockey," he said, "I understand that during that meeting in the hotel room, Alan Freed said, 'This song is like nothing I've ever heard before. It's not race music, and it's not rhythm and blues,' which is what the kind of categories they have. 'It's something different. And we got to find a description of it.'" So they were talking away, and Billy Ward said, "You know, there's a line in the song, 'I'll rock you, I'll roll you, I'll love you all night.'" And Alan Freed said, "Why don't we call it rock and roll?" So my sponsor, Milton, was in the room when they named rock and roll. I mean, that's like being there when somebody said, "Why don't we call it Christianity?" You know. So they took him down, they got the t-shirts, and as he was leaving the gift shop, the guy gave him a full leather bomber jacket
with
Cleveland Rock and Roll Museum. So that was the way I got to thank my sponsor. He came home and he started talking about it for the first time in a long time. But oddly enough, as he was leaving the Rock and Roll Museum, the executive director said, "Milton, I've met a lot of guys from your era, a lot of you guys from that time." And he said, "You're the first one I met who was not bitter about it, because those guys got screwed. You know, those performers got no money, no residuals. The producers made a fortune off of them, and they made nothing." And Milton said, "I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 34 years. I can't afford to be bitter." And the guy went, "Whoa." So Milton came back and started talking about that, and people got excited about it. He was interviewed on the radio, and he got to kind of put it in the place that it needed to be in his life. And it was just before he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So God presents us opportunities sometimes that are terrific. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it in a way that I can't even describe to you. I love it in the way that it's simply part of my substance. It's part of who I am. I have been here long enough that it is settled into the bottom parts of my soul. And there's still part of me, that disease part of me that fights it. You know, there's still a part of me that says, "Yeah, but, yeah." You might be missing something. You know, we all search for happiness, and we all search for love, and we all search for all kinds of excitement and all kinds of things. But there is an enormous amount to be said for contentment. I'm a grateful, contented man, and I want to thank you for asking me to be here. I have loved being here. Let me tell you something. If you're new and you're wondering what this is about, this is something that Mother Teresa wrote. She was not just another pretty face. People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you have anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and your God. It was never between you and them anyway. God bless you.